cause number 13-19-486 CV, MSW Corpus Christi Landfill Limited versus Gully Hurst LLC, Robert Brian Gully individually, and Philip R. Hurst individually.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. This is a tale of two cases. This is the case that the trial court thought it was, and the trial court was not the fact finder. And we had the case that the jury found it was. The jury, of course, was the fact finder. The trial court made prohibited credibility determinations and factual findings early on in this case, which left MSW with one very limited claim and very limited damages to take to the jury. Then the jury heard this case, heard much of the same evidence that the trial court had heard pre-trial, and rendered a completely different verdict with completely different credibility findings and factual determinations. This jury determined that Gully Hurst did not comply with its purchase terms in this real estate contract. That failure to comply was not excused. MSW didn't waive compliance, and MSW did not fail to comply. The jury also found MSW was entitled to all of the damages that were submitted to it by the court in the jury charge. Those damages were supported by expert witness testimony from an economist who carefully. So as we said, the jury's verdict was rendered entirely in favor of MSW, entirely against Gully Hurst. It's important to remember as we review this appeal, Gully Hurst has not challenged any of the findings of the jury in this case that it failed to comply with the purchase terms of this real estate sales contract. So what are we appealing? We've got a JNOV. We have a jury charge that didn't submit all of MSW's damage elements to which it was entitled. We've got multiple summary judgments that were granted that should not have been granted. We're seeking extensive relief from this court. First and foremost, we're asking the court to reinstate this jury verdict because this was MSW's consequential loss. That is the value of its interest in this landfill, which Gully Hurst has taken without paying for. And we also ask the court to affirm the judgment on the lost use of the money and then affirm that entire judgment as modified. So therefore, what we're asking for is judgment on the verdict.
Let's begin with reinstating the verdict, the $10 million plus.
Yes.
Does that amount that the jury awarded assume that MSW would have sold its share of the landfill after GH failed to close on this deal?
Well, that damage measure, Your Honor, is the damage measure that the law says is submitted in the case when you've got breach of a real estate contract. Whether the seller breaches, the purchaser, the buyer breaches, that is the damage measure that the law provides. It's the difference between the contract price and the market value. That's the damage.
And I understand that's being argued, and Mr. Bell, I'm sure, will address that in terms of whether that was the proper valuation or formulation. But I guess I'm a little confused here because if we go with GH failed to close, and so under the terms of the agreement, you should have all just resumed the litigation according to the fourth paragraph. And so at that point, you would have just been back to where you were, both joint owners and in a dispute.
Yes.
So where does the money value come from at that point?
Well, because we didn't ever get to that point. What happened is Gully Hurst failed to comply with its purchase terms, which had a defined, they were defined, they had a defined
Correct.
Time period, right? And then what happened? Gully Hurst doesn't comply with those terms, but takes our deed and runs off with it. They're still holding our deed. They filed it immediately. It's recorded of record. The evidence throughout this case shows Gully Hurst has been holding itself out as a 100% interest owner in this landfill. MSW went into this contract as one half owner of this asset. Right. It's a $35 million asset. What I'd like to remind the court is that let's look at the JNOV. As we know, the basis for granting a JNOV is extremely limited. JNOVs are very rare. Very rarely do we ever set aside a jury verdict. Well, the
second case that we have set for today is also a JNOV.
So there's a theme today. Well, and I'm going to tell you, this JNOV, like so many that came before it, has got to be reversed. And here's why. Number one, the trial court told us why JNOV was granted. She said, well, the damage measure I submitted to the jury was incorrect. Now, this is after extensive pretrial briefing on this damage measure. This is a real estate contract case. We know what the damage measure is. The law provides for it. Second, the court went in and actually tweaked this jury question before it was submitted. And then third said, this measure as submitted, I believe, is a fact issue. We know from the record what happened. The trial court didn't like the verdict because at the beginning of the JNOV hearing, the court came on the bench and said, I did not take this lightly after the verdict came in. I have to tell you that. She said, I even went back to find out fair market value, but no motion had even been filed yet. A court can't grant a JNOV sua sponte. So you had 12 Nueces County juries who listened to this case over multiple weeks. There was even a whole-
But fair market value wasn't even a term that was used in the charge. There was no instruction to the jury or definition to use quote unquote fair market value.
Well, let me just look at the, well, first of all, let me just double check the question. Yeah, let's see. Market value, Your Honor. The difference between the price to be paid by GH to purchase MSW's half and the, market value.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. So
got
the
it.
Jury,
okay.
And again, that's what the law says is the damage measure. And we've presented to you multiple cases. There's no question that's what the damage measure. Gully Hurst recognizes. Yes, Your Honor.
Can I ask you this too? But doesn't she also award you the 372 based on the loss of the 10 million?
No, Your Honor. No. The 372 is a completely different damage. As you will recall, MSW got a loan to purchase its half of the landfill back in the beginning, the Ameristate loan. It was a $5 million loan. Ameristate, one of the things that Gully Hurst was supposed to do to purchase MSW's half was refinance that loan. GH never refinanced the loan. The jury was asked that question because GH said, oh, we complied. We did everything we were supposed to do. The jury said, no, you didn't. MSW still stuck on that in that Ameristate loan. So the evidence showed that MSW was unable to take those funds tied up in that loan and invest them somewhere else and do something else with the money. The 372 is the loss of use of the money. Our expert.
But only the loan money.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Absolutely. Only the loan. Yes, we had three very distinct and separate damage models. It was transactional loss, which is what's our value of the one half interest in the landfill minus the sales price. Then we had lost profits, which the court, by the way, refused to submit and should have, and we'll get to that. And then we had lost use of the money, which is our loss of the $5 million tied up in that Ameristate loan that MSW should have been able to get back and take it to go do something else with. So those are the three different damages.
So why did you all not, if they failed to close after the 120 days, why did you all not go back to the trial court, file your motion for continuance instead of dismissing the case? Why did y'all dismiss the litigation?
Your Honor, I can't speak to that. All I can say is we are here and we are deep in it and in the litigation. And I will say, too, that remember, the jury was asked whether or not MSW waived GH's compliance. And that was one of the waiver arguments. And the jury found in favor of MSW, no, you did not waive. That's respectfully just water under the bridge at this point. So what we know is the JNOV was not properly granted because it was the proper damage measure. The law supports it. So the court statement, I submitted the incorrect measure, that's wrong. The JNOV's got to be reversed. So then did Gully Hurst raise a cross point? They did, but what's their cross point? Oh, they flipped the numbers. Nobody flipped the numbers. The expert testified clearly, distinctly, and repeatedly that was a false premise that GH cooked up. The expert explained there is no numbers flipping here, and the jury didn't buy it either. The jury was the fact finder. Gully Hurst recognizes this was a contract for sale. That contract is very clear about purchase obligations and timing. The jury was asked about purchase obligations and timing. The jury found Gully Hurst failed to comply. The expert testified to the consequential loss of that in this case, because Kelly Hurst took the deed and didn't pay for it, our consequential loss, that is the loss that flows naturally, but not necessarily from the breach, is our inability to sell that interest to a third party. Kelly Hurst says market value minus sales price only works if the seller breaches, but that fails to account for what happened in this case, which as you know, and we said repeatedly, Kelly Hurst took our deed, ran off with it, holds itself out as owner, hasn't paid for it. So what's the consequence of that? Kelly Hurst didn't comply with the purchase terms. The jury found they didn't comply. Kelly Hurst hasn't contested those liability findings. So now all bets are off. Kelly Hurst cannot enforce that contract now. They cannot enforce those purchase terms now. The law does not allow a breaching party to enforce a contract. So now they've got to pay market value. That's what the expert testified to. You know, I thought it was interesting. The other thing he said was MSW did not get the benefit of getting out of the deal. And that's exactly right, because under this agreement, if Kelly Hurst didn't comply with the purchase terms, they were supposed to walk away. And instead, what did they do? They took our deed and they walked away, and now they haven't paid for it.
Now, they do argue that they have paid the note, the Ameristate Bank note, that MSW has not had to incur that. And I understand the argument that MSW is still on the hook for that note. Yes. But I have a question about paragraph two and the language that's used with regard to the lien for that note, because as you know, Mr. Bell or Appley is arguing that that's a permitted exception to the clear title requirement. So the language that says MSW shall provide clear title to GH by special warranty deed to its one half interest, subject only to those conditions of the title accepted in the purchase of the one half of the land hill, 2000, the liens in favor of American State Bank securing, what does that mean? What was contemplated by that language?
I cannot speak to, Your Honor. I'm not sure. I wasn't there. And of course, this is a mediated settlement agreement. But I will say this, though. What I think what's clear when you look at this is the only way MSW was conveying clear title is if Kelly Hurst paid for it. There were three obligations that Kelly Hurst had under this agreement. Writing off the $3.5 million note, which, as has been pointed out throughout this case, it's a now you see it, now you don't kind of thing with them in that $3.5 million note. They write it off when they need to. It's still on the books when they need it over here. In any event, that was one of three purchase obligations. Kelly Hurst did not comply with the other two, which were submitted to the jury, and the jury found they did not comply, and Kelly Hurst has not contested those. So the last thing, well, I want to point out another thing, which is Kelly Hurst said in its JNOV motion that this the market value minus sales price might be appropriate if the MSA was an option contract and GH failed to purchase. Well, the MSA was an option contract. It checks all the boxes of an option contract, and Kelly Hurst failed to purchase. But the trial court refused to submit that question to the jury, as it should have. So ultimately on this, Kelly Hurst says we're going to get a windfall if the verdict's reinstated. And that's absolutely false. We were one half owners of this $35 million asset before all these shenanigans. GH has taken our deed and filed it. We've got to be paid for that. That's our consequential loss. GH has its half. Its half isn't going anywhere. No one's taking that away from GH if this verdict is reinstated. And the jury's verdict accounts for those two loans. So out of MSW's half, we're taking out the 7.5. Now Kelly Hurst can go pay off the loans. Everybody is compensated fairly and completely in that way. If the verdict is not reinstated, Kelly Hurst runs off with a $35 million asset without paying for it. We have no lost profits. We have no value of our interest. And we're still on the Ameristate loan for $5 million. We have got to have this verdict reinstated for all the reasons that I've addressed. In the alternative, we still own the deed. If we don't get paid for our deed, it's still our deed. We're entitled to have it back. We should have had a lost profits submission because the jury was asked, did Kelly Hurst comply with its purchase terms? Did they fail to comply with the purchase terms is the way it was submitted. If the jury found, yes, they failed to comply, then Kelly Hurst didn't purchase. So then now we're still a 50% owner in an ongoing concern. We're entitled to 50% of the profits. We pled it, we proved it, our expert proved meticulously $3.7 million as of the time of the July 2019 trial. Bellyhurst doesn't really object to the computation. They just say, oh, you don't own it, you conveyed your interest. But let's talk about conveyance of interest. The court granted summary judgment on that. It could never have granted summary judgment finding that we conveyed our interest. Intent to convey is a fact issue. We know that. That's time-honored legal precedent in the state of Texas. Tom Nunes testified pre-trial just as he did at trial. He had no intent to convey. And the MSA makes clear we were both owners. Somebody had to buy the other person's interest, and there had to be a closing. GH didn't purchase. There was no closing. We did not convey our interest. At a minimum, that was a jury question that should have been submitted. Now, I know Bellyhurst has a cross point, and I guess we'll get to that later, but all we would say is the court should affirm the judgment on lost use of money. If you take that away too and leave us with no claims and no damages, we will not have been compensated, and there will be no consequences for Bellyhurst's breach.
Thank you, Ms. McNair. Mr. Bell?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to discuss the issues in this case. All of us have learned a lot how to do things differently over the last year, and I appreciate the court's professionalism and especially of your staff and making all this work for us. This morning, my wife reminded me to make sure to polish my shoes so I'd make a good impression with the court today. But I had to tell her it was going to be a little bit different. We're not quite
well,
doing
if it. If it makes you feel better, you can lift your leg up and we can look at
for the record, I am wearing shoes. This is basically a contract dispute over a mediated settlement agreement, as the court's aware. And representatives of MSW testified about all sorts of perceptions they had about the agreement, what they thought was meant by the agreement, what they intended to do in the agreement, experiences they had in other closings of transactions. But it all comes down to what the mediated settlement agreement actually said. Time and time again, we came back to the old parole evidence rule. The agreement speaks for itself. And all of those perceptions, thoughts, intentions, and experiences really are irrelevant. Now, it's important, and I think the court recognizes this, that Bellyhurst and MSW were involved in a prior lawsuit in County Court 2 on the operation of a landfill. Bellyhurst had originally developed a landfill. They sold a half interest to MSW. MSW borrowed $5 million from Ameristate Bank, and both parties pledged 100% of the landfill to secure that debt. MSW also agreed to pay a $3.5 million loan to Bellyhurst. Now, MSW was operating the landfill, but after 2 years, Bellyhurst terminated them, and they got in a lawsuit with each other in disputing over how it was terminated. We mediated settlement of that lawsuit with Marvin Niebrat. And the terms of that were pretty simple. We needed to basically end the relationship. And so MSW had the option, it was clearly an option, to buy out Bellyhurst. But if that didn't happen, then the next three things were very specific and not optional by any language in the agreement and by any logical reason of the parties. First, MSW was required to provide clear title to the property to Bellyhurst by delivery of a deed. Second, Bellyhurst would write off the $3.5 million note. And third, Bellyhurst would then have 120 days to go and refinance the loan at Ameristate Bank. The end result is they would no longer be joint owners. That was critical for the settlement. And both parties released their liens, claims against each other. Now, what really happened? On September 24 of 2015, when the 120 days was up, the counsel for the parties started letters to each other and emails discussing how to go to phase two under section two of the agreement. An escrow arrangement was requested, that was rejected. Closing through a title company was requested and that was rejected. The attorneys then discuss an arrangement where the deed would be sent first and the next day the note would come. They decided not to do that. And so the parties FedExed the instruments to each other on the same day so that they would arrive at the other office and they could do it that way. So the deed was
during those 120 days for Gully Hirsch. Were efforts at refinancing actually attempted? Because it seems that's what this it hinges on, this understanding of arranging. Where's the language? Now I've lost it here. Arranging to finance.
Arranging for the refinancing. Yes. Well, and actually, we had a big case over that. Gully Hirsch did make efforts to refinance the loan. We claimed that MSW stymied those efforts. We agree to disagree on that. The jury found us against us on that issue, and we don't see a need to retry that.
But isn't that a fact issue as to whether that was determined by the jury that you did fail to refinance, which was one of the terms?
That's correct.
And it seems that the fact that the word closing is used in two places, in paragraph 2 and in paragraph 4, that a closing was contemplated as part of this deal, and that didn't occur.
Well, Your Honor, actually, it didn't talk about a closing in the second part. It talked about three things very specifically happening. And those three things were, first, that MSW would provide a special warranty deed to provide clear title to the landfill, and Gully Hirsch would write off that $3.5 million loan. Those were the two things that were specifically required. Now, it did say later that if anyone had any closing costs or wanted to get a title policy, that would be borne at the expense of Gully Hirsch. But Gully Hirsch never saw a need to get a title policy because they basically already had one. They already owned half, and they had a title policy on the half that was conveyed to MSW. So a new title policy was not required. And so the way the agreement was structured, it was a 1-2-3, and that the first thing was MSW had to deliver the deed. Secondly, Gully Hirsch had to write off the debt. And thirdly, Gully Hirsch then had 120 days to go refinance the loan at Ameristate Bank. And so, yes, the jury found in question number one that Gully Hirsch failed to arrange for the refinancing. But the real question is, what are the remedies available to MSW for that failure to refinance? They could have sought specific performance because the settlement agreement was enforceable under Rule 11. The case was kept on the docket, but they didn't do that. Did they have to make any payments? Did they have to, did they lose any credit because of this? The jury specifically answered question 6 with $0 for any damages to the credit of the principals involved. Now, in MSW's issue number one, they assert as their damage model a claim that they should get half of the value of the landfill. But that caused us a lot of consternation when the court initially ruled against us. So we consulted Professor Laycock at UT Law School, who teaches damages, just to give us a reality check on that issue. He gave us a lot of case authorities, but the basic issue is really pretty simple. The fundamental purpose of contract damages is to put the party where they would have been had the contract been performed. In this case, the jury found that we failed to complete the refinancing on time. That simply means, okay, they still are on the hook for $4.6 million. Did they have to make any loan payments? No. Did they lose any of their credit reputation? No. Did they have a lost opportunity cost? Well, maybe, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But under no sequence of events would they have been entitled to get half of the landfill back. That was an accomplished fact.
But had you been put back into the position that you were at the time that you entered into this agreement, then MSW would have been half owner.
Well, that would have made us go back two previous steps. And the only thing the jury found was that we failed to complete the refinancing in 120 days. The agreement did not say if you fail to complete the refinancing in 120 days, then all bets are off. And in fact, a fundamental principle of contract law is that if one covenant to an agreement with many covenants is breached, then the law will seek what is the damages for the breach of that one covenant. It's very rare, and we'll get to this rescission argument later, but what they're trying to do is rescind the agreement, and rescission is not an appropriate remedy in this case. But under the restatement, it's a simple fundamental fact that The benefit of the bargain is that the person should be put in a position they would have been in had the contract been performed. And if the contract had been performed, the only thing that MSW didn't have was they were still liable on a note. And what are their damages for still being liable on that note? They don't have the right to get into a better position by getting their property back than they would have been, because if the contract had been performed, that's the only difference, is they would have been on the note.
Well, let me ask, I need to go back on that one point though still, because what concerns me or bothers me is paragraph four that says, assumes that neither party, you know, does what they're supposed to do on the purchase or the sale. So at that point then, you both have are supposed to file a joint motion for continuance of the lawsuit, get a trial setting, which in other words, puts you back to where you were in litigation as joint owners.
Well, isn't no, Section 4 doesn't really state that. Section 4 in the agreement says that we'd file a joint motion of continuance, keep the case on the docket so that this Rule 11 agreement was enforceable.
And get a trial setting. And get a trial setting as soon as you can. So in other words, proceed with the dispute, proceed with the litigation to a trial.
Well, that if for some reason that we didn't do what we wanted to do, but the reality was we appeared at docket call after the 120 days had elapsed, and MSW's counsel represented the court along with me that there was no need for a trial in this case, that we passed the case. And so the 10 days after that, we provided refinancing documents, or what we considered were refinancing documents, to MSW. MSW refused to sign them. 4 months after that, the case was dismissed for want of prosecution. So the whole concept of saying that if for some reason that the deal didn't happen under the settlement agreement, we go back to court was true. But in this case, only one covenant in the agreement was breached, and that was the failure to complete the refinancing in 120 days. That's the only thing that was found by the jury. The jury did not find that it was an option contract. The jury did not find that there was a failure to close. The jury simply find that we didn't refinance in time. And so the sole issue is, what are the damages for failure to refinance on time?
Why isn't rescission a proper remedy?
Why is rescission not a proper remedy?
Correct.
Well, that is their issue number four, or I'm sorry, their issue number five. And rescission is an equitable remedy when damages are not available. And so normally in any contract case, in a mediated settlement agreement is just like any other contract. If there is a failure to perform one covenant, we look at, well, what are the damages for the failure of that one covenant, which is what the jury found and the jury was asked to decide. You normally only get the equitable remedy of rescission when there's some fraud, accident, or mistake. And very critically, the parties are not continuing to enjoy the benefits of the agreement. In this case, MSW is still, to this day, enjoying all the benefits of the agreement. They're not making any payments on the Ameristate bank loan. They don't have any liabilities associated with the debt or the operation landfill.
What about the personal guarantees of each of the
MSW? The personal guarantees are there, but very significantly, Your Honor, the jury found zero damages to any of the guarantors for the failure to release those personal guarantees. That was a question asked to the jury, and the jury came back with zero on that. And so a party that continues to enjoy all the benefits, the other benefits, very significantly, Gully Hurst released all of its claims against MSW for mismanagement that were in that 2013 lawsuit. Those claims were released. MSW has the benefit of that release. And so everything, they're still enjoying those benefits, and rescission is not an available remedy when a party's still enjoying all the benefits of the bargain. Now, the second issue about the lost profits is very similar to the first issue, in that, again, MSW is trying to get to a point far better than where they would have been had the contract been performed and the loan had been refinanced. If the loan had been refinanced MSW would not be entitled to half the profits in the law firm. So there's a big disconnect between what they're trying to get and where they would have been had the contract been performed as required. The buyer's entitled to lost profits if the seller refuses to close a sale, but in this case, MSW was the seller. Now, they raise all the time, and MSW's counsel has argued time and time again that this was an option contract. But this whole argument that it's an option contract fails just as a matter of common sense. There's nothing optional in the language of Section 2. It's very clear that Section 1 creates an option, but there's not any type of option or conditions expressed in Section 2. It simply says MSW shall provide clear title to Gully Hearst by special warranty deed. That is not optional. And keep in mind, the parties needed a divorce. The settlement was to guarantee that they would no longer be joint owners of the landfill anymore. The second part couldn't have been an option, because if it was an option, then at the end of the day, they would still be joint owners, and that would defeat the whole purpose of the settlement agreement. And so they had to consider this as mandatory in Section 2 and not optional. Lastly, there was no credible basis that the court could find to establish any type of intention for a bailment, an escrow, or a trust agreement, just because one of the parties of the plaintiff says he didn't intend to convey property doesn't negate the fact that he signed a deed, that his attorney delivered the deed to the grantee, that there was no bailment agreement, there was no escrow agreement, no trust agreement. That deed was recorded. And this own court ruled in 1983 in a case that the undisclosed intention by a party doesn't negate the execution, delivery, and recordation of a deed by the attorney. So the deed was an effective conveyance. There's no question about that. And the trial court summary judgment on that should be valid as a matter of law. Now, in issue number 7 on the claim of fraud, this was the last summary judgment granted by the trial court. And I'd like to focus on that briefly. The law is very clear that there is no duty of disclosure when without evidence of a confidential or fiduciary relationship. And after all the discovery for 2.5 years, after several motions for summary judgment and discussion on this issue, MSW could not establish any evidence of a confidential or fiduciary relationship. The parties were joint owners of real estate. That was their sole relationship between the parties. And the law is very clear that joint ownership of real estate, even this court in 1987 confirmed that, does not create a fiduciary interest. The parties also were in litigation in 2013, and MSW had the right through discovery to get all the financial information that it wanted. It did not seek any of that financial information or any additional discovery. The Supreme Court recently confirmed in the Mercedes-Benz versus Carduco case that came through this court that in a arm's length transaction, there is no duty of disclosure. And that we can disagree about that. We can agree to disagree. But the reality is, in this case, there was no duty of disclosure. Whether the duty arises is a question of law. And so, therefore, summary judgment was proper. The last thing I'd like to address is our point number one on appeal, that there was no evidence to support the jury's answer to question number 3-2 about lost opportunity cost. The issue is, to what extent did MSW actually lose an opportunity because we failed to refinance a loan? And the court really should focus on that, because that was the sole jury finding. That was the sole breach of the settlement agreement, was the failure to refinance a loan. But keep in mind that Gully Hearst refinancing that $4.6 million would not have put $4.6 million in MSW's pocket It would just enable them to borrow that money from a bank and invest it elsewhere. Now, the courts are very clear that the amount of lost opportunity has to be shown with reasonable certainty. And an expert saying it so doesn't make it that way. The Supreme Court's required that a reasonable certainty cannot be established when the loss is speculative or dependent upon uncertain and changing market conditions. A critical case that I think the court should examine is Basic Capital Management versus Dynex Commercial, decided by the Dallas Court of Appeals. The expert in that case testified about what the plaintiff wanted to do with the funds that it could borrow. It was in the business of real estate investment trusts, and it would invest that money in another real estate investment trust. So the expert testified about the rate of return on the plaintiff's other real investment trusts, and also what the market was generally for real estate investment trusts, and the court upheld that damage model. In contrast, in this case, the plaintiffs testified if they got that money, they would have invested it in a landfill, a McKinney landfill, that they testified wasn't even open yet. And their own expert testified that the Gully Hearst landfill for the first 5 years never even turned a profit. And so that wouldn't create any damages. So the expert had turned to a hypothetical model about finding some investment that theoretically would generate a rate of return sufficient to not only pay the interest on the loan of $4,600,000, but also generate a rate of return. And Your Honor, that is a mythical investment in my opinion. You can't find one. It's purely hypothetical. And so we respectfully request that the court affirm the trial court's judgment on the 7 points of appeal raised by MSW, and that you would reverse and render as to the 1 point about this $4.6 million lost opportunity, because there simply is no real basis with any substantial certainty to support that in the record. Thank you very much.
I have one follow-up question, though. And Ms. McNair, since you technically took a little extra time, we'll give Mr. Bell a little extra time to answer this question. I still have a question about the argument you've made in your brief where you say MSW had an unconditional obligation to provide clear title, and the $5 million note is specifically listed as a permitted exception to the clear title requirement. So I assume you're referring to the language that I asked Ms. McNair about earlier, which says the warranty deed subject only to those conditions of title accepted, blah, blah, blah. What does that language mean in paragraph two?
Well, it's kind of a 1-2-3 transaction, and that in September 24th, at the end of the 120 days, the first step was MSW would provide clear title by delivery of a special warranty deed. And secondly, Gully Hearst would write off the $3.5 million note.
Right. Now, but subject to the liens in favor of the bank. Go ahead. You're going to explain that.
Correct. The elephant in the room was the Ameristate bank loan for $5 million that was a lien against the property. So when we say that MSW should provide clear title, we recognize that that clear title would be subject to the Ameristate bank loan, which Gully Hearst then had 120 days to go refinance. It would also be subject to any other matters of record when Gully Hearst originally sold the property.
And but so, if you had refinanced within that time, wouldn't it have cleared that lien?
That's correct. It would have probably been replaced with another bank loan. And that was Gully Hearst's covenant, was to refinance that loan within 120 days, which the jury determined that we failed to do.
Okay,
but,
right.
But that's the only thing that we failed to do. But the title, the parties recognized that during that 120 days, title would be subject to that Ameristate bank loan. That's correct.
It's during the 120 days. Okay. Wanted to clear that up in my head. Thank you very much, Mr. Bell. All right, Ms.
Thank
McNair, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. But remember, within the 120 days, an express purchase term was to refinance that loan, which the jury expressly found did not happen. That was a purchase term. GH cannot retry this case now. It's already been tried to a jury. We've already got a jury verdict on all these issues related to this mediated settlement agreement. The jury's already spoken, and Gully Hearst doesn't contest the findings. This mediated settlement agreement, Chief Justice Contreras, you brought up closing. Throughout this mediated settlement agreement, you see closing costs as part of the sale. at the status of the lawsuit upon closing of the sale in paragraph four. And it says and then the controversy in connection with the suit shall have been compromised thereby if there had been a closing of the sale. There was no closing of the sale. We remain, as the preamble states, 50% half-half owners of this landfill.
Well, let me ask you about that, because Mr. Bell said that the MSA doesn't provide for that. The MSA doesn't say if you all fail to live up to one or two, you go back to the positions you were in prior to this agreement. He says it doesn't provide for that. So if it doesn't, then what is the remedy?
Well, it does provide for that, Your Honor. It's very clear what GH's purchase terms are. It has three obligations, and it had to comply with all three. We suggested also that the writing off of the $3.5 million note was a fact issue, but everybody said, oh no, the judge thought too, no, it's been written up. These are all the purchase terms. You can't just do one. If we were in a real estate transaction and you were going to buy my house, if you ran off with my deed and didn't comply with the purchase terms, am I really going to say, oh, sure, you can just have it for our agreement? No, it's market value now. That was what our expert testified to. That's what's so important in this case. This is a real estate contract. They took our deed. They had terms and conditions they were supposed to comply with timely. They didn't do it. They can't enforce those terms now. They no longer get the benefit of the deal, and they've got to pay us for one half of our interest. Again, the jury has spoken on this. The MSA is clear. They suggest we should have sought specific performance. Why would we do that? Gullyhurst had a set period of time. If they didn't comply with the deal, we were back to square one. Why do we want to, if Gullyhurst refuses to comply, why are we going to specifically perform those provisions? It's too late now. The time has passed. They refer to an expert. I want to point out that this expert was never presented to the jury, Professor Laycock. The jury never heard from him. He came in at JNOV time. We objected at the time. We do think it's improper to suggest that there's expert testimony in this case on contract issues for Gullyhurst when there are none. They talk about enforcing the contract and the benefit of the bargain. Remember, that's one kind of contract damage. There's also consequential damages. And that's what our expert testified to, consequential damages, the damages that naturally flow from the breach. What's the breach? Gullyhurst had purchase terms. They didn't comply with the purchase terms. They took our deed and filed it anyway. What is the consequential damage? We still don't have our deed. They still have our deed. It's March of 2021. We get our market value. We should be compensated for that deed, which is what the jury found and what the law provides supports the model. As to the fraud, I just want to mention, we all know as a matter of law, you can't lie to each other during a real estate transaction. You can't defraud each other during a real estate transaction. If you make material misrepresentations to me during our transaction, that's a fraud case every time. We've all seen them. They're brought routinely. Gullyhurst lied to MSW about the financial wherewithal of this landfill so MSW wouldn't purchase and Gullyhurst could go sell it to somebody else. We should have been able to try that to a jury. As to lost use of the money, we are very clear. Lost use of money and lost profits are two different things. Gullyhurst is relying on lost profits cases. Basic Capital is a lost profits case. Those are cases where you have to show a defined investment in which you lost profits. Lost use of money is when you don't have any financing at all. You cannot close any deals at all. That's what happened to the entity MSW. Individuals set aside, that's completely different. What happened with them, what the jury decided with them is entirely separate from MSW as the entity, which is tied up in this AmeriState loan, could not do any other deals. We had an economist testify clearly as to what our damage issue was on that case, and the jury so found. So we would ask the court to reinstate the jury verdict, modify that judgment, and affirm it as modified so that we have a judgment on the verdict as the law and the record require. Otherwise, we're still one half owner. We want our deed back. We want our lost profits. We want all the other causes of action that were taken away from us and that should have been tried to a jury. And unless the court has questions, we appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate your argument, and the case will be under submission.